CoinWorld Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about CoinWorld Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast with your host, Jeff Stark.
And as I've said from day one of this show, this is a big tent hobby. There's a lot of room for folks.
And Larry Jewett.
And learning has been such a tremendous amount of this journey.
The CoinWorld Podcast.
CoinWorld Podcast is back. And yes, believe it or not, we survived the great eclipse of 2024. And looking forward to when it comes to Florida in 2044. I'm Larry Jewett.
And I'm Jeff Stark. And yeah, it's it was earlier this week, last week, depending on when you listen to this. It was such a cool event to go to. And it really I started getting excited about it when I wrote about Eclipse coins and metals for the World Coin section a few months back. And it really was fun. My younger sister brought her family and our mother down to Poplar Bluff, Missouri. We had sun-kissed soda, Starburst candies, sun chips, moon pies, all of the appropriately themed snacks. Donuts from the special Eclipse donuts from Krispy Kreme. So it was a good time. So cool. I hope for those who have not had a chance to witness it that they're you're around and can make it down to the path of totality in 20 years. I was in Sydney in 2017 when the last eclipse, you know, came through the mainland U.S. and it was not in totality. And I remember thinking, okay, this is cool, but it was less than underwhelming, especially compared to totality. Totality makes a total difference. So anyway, yeah, that's the big goings on outside the hobby this week. We're going to talk about all the stuff that's happening inside the hobby. And you want to stick around for my interview with Joe Cronin, the author of a new book on Henning Nichols. What a fun area of the hobby. And he's presented a whole lot of information on this. And it's really one of those must-have books for the specialist, but you'll hear all about that in a little bit.
I'm excited to hear that. I was unfortunately unavailable for that one, but I'm excited to hear what Joe has to say. Appreciate everything he's done with us with the Men Errors to Die For book that he did a few years back. And we've had opportunities to talk to him about some of the readers ask things. And Joe is a great source of knowledge here. And I'm sure the book is going to be incredible as well. But, you know, we talked about at the beginning, as I was taking care of another situation there, we were talking about the eclipse because the moon is round, the sun is round, and it just seems like, you know, round things have a lot of relevance to us, especially if you're into numismatics, because, of course, as we mentioned earlier, coins are round, not always, but most of the time they are, but most of the time, too, so are metals. And metals are an area where a lot of folks, once they find the opportunity to collect them, then they get the idea that there's a lot of potential out there. I know Ian Lang up at Gate West Coins, he is a metal collector, and there are many who are metal collectors, many who are members of the TAMS group, the Token and Metal Society. But metals have a lot of potential. And if you're looking at something that may be a good collectible, metals are still very, very popular. They have historic connotations. We're going to have a story coming up by Steve Roach on a recent metal sale that was held. And one of our big stories coming up has to deal with a congressional gold medal presentation. There was just one recently on the Ghost Army. And there was another one that was held on April the 10th, not letting the cat out of the bag here because we announced it back in September. But that was on the World War II effort of the Ladies of the Nation who were helping us out in the war effort. They weren't wearing uniforms necessarily, but they were an integral part for the nation's success, and that is the Rosie the Riveter. Now, if I'm not mistaken, back in December, didn't you have the opportunity to interact with some of the individuals who were involved in the war effort from back in the 40s?
Yeah. Yes. Great, great memory. And you took me where I was going to go anyway. During the trip to Pearl Harbor with my sister and our mother and her older son, we got to meet the day before Pearl Harbor anniversary day. So December 6th, you know, the attack was December 7th, the day that shall live in infamy. The day before, the folks at the national park there had two tables set up. One table had five and one table had four ladies that are still around today that had actually served during the war, wartime effort, World War II, in various capacities in munitions plants, in plants making tanks and planes and some of the heavy machinery of war, all of that. These ladies came from all over, and it was such a thrill and a delight to get to meet them and hear their story and get a few things signed by them. I got some postcards signed by him. And I know, you know, the thing was, it was so neat to see so many people that wanted to meet and honor these ladies. They were just going to be there signing for like an hour and a half or 2 hours. And so many people in line just could not get anything signed because the lines were so long. It was such a popular thing for them to do. And I understand, you know, the ladies, you can't sit out in the sun all day, and you know, it's tiring, especially at their age and all that. So I just feel fortunate that I was able to get to meet them and get a few things signed. And I love this medal. You're referencing the medal that's the cover of the latest issue of Coin World with a story from our colleague Paul Jilks. Gorgeous design on both sides of the medal. My hope is that I can encounter one of these medals in the aftermarket several years from now. I've been able to obtain U.S. Mint medals, relatively recent U.S. Mint medals, that way. Let the initial buyer pay the money for the metal that the U.S. Mint is asking. It continues to baffle and frustrate me that the U.S. Mint charges now $20 for a small bronze metal and $160 for a 3-inch bronze metal, when private entities in the U.S. can make 1-ounce copper rounds for wholesale, that wholesale for $1 a piece. Now, I understand the artistry is so much better on these U.S. Mint metals. You know, there's a structured design process with the, you know, all the different artists that are solicited to make the designs and so on. But it used to be $6 for a small bronze medal, and it used to be, I don't know, $40-$45 for a large one until a few years ago. And now it's just, it's cost prohibitive, certainly for me, for others. I mean, yeah, could I drop $20 on a small bronze medal? Sure, I can afford it. But dude, for like 50% more, I can get a 1-ounce silver coin that maybe has a limited mintage, has a theme, whether that's a comic book hero or a pretty animal or something. There's just a disconnect in this. And it really frustrates me because some of the best design work from U.S. artists have been featured on these medals. And it's prohibitive for many folks to obtain them. Just, you know, even if it's not prohibitive in a true sense, it's silly to me, the price that is being charged. And, you know, the mints of business, I know they got to make money, cover the cost. I do seem to feel a disconnect there with between reality and the market. And the mint can go, hey, you know, as long as we sell even less than a third of the metals that we used to on any given issue, we're still making money. And, you know, Okay, great. But that just means that two-thirds of the audience has been shut out of this numismatic celebration. And it irks me, if you couldn't tell.
Yeah, well, I think that was one of the points that was made by readers when it was originally announced that the increase was going to go up there. It was going to be like, you're going to reach a point where it's going to be cost prohibitive, because for many people, this is a hobby. And oftentimes a hobby, as far as expendable income goes, a hobby is well down the list of priorities. I mean, you're not going to stop buying groceries. You're not going to stop some of your entertainment options like that. If you have them, you're not going to, certainly not going to cut out your access to the internet type thing. Something's got to give somewhere. And if this becomes an optional purchase, then it's subjecting itself to the possibility that it's not going to be made. And then, you know, you look at it on the other side of it. Well, they didn't sell very many of them. That makes them rare. So on the resale, they might be, you know, even more valuable there. But I mean, there's no easy answer to any of this. I mean, we all want to try to have things that are affordable. We all want, that way we can enhance our experiences and that type of thing. And some people will pay that. Some people have no problem with it. God love them. But I think it's one of those pyramid type situations where only the top third of the pyramid is really going to be able to make the purchase because of price point and or because of the expendable income that they have there. But as you noted, that, you know, selling fewer of them, they're still going to realize what they have. I mean, there's analysts that are holed up in windowless offices who figure all this stuff out. That's not me. So this is just an opinion. So just the idea, but that price point notwithstanding, they're beautiful works of art, bottom line.
Oh, and, absolutely. You know,
and it's a good cause. And it's just like the same way I felt about the Greatest Generation commemorative coins. It's something that really pays honor to something that's very special to a lot of us. And this would fall into that same category. And that's what makes a buying thing difficult. You know, if you can't afford it, do you want it? If you can't afford it, then it's a no-brainer. You can't get it. But if you can, are you willing to commit that kind of thing? I mean, the timing on this, I owe the IRS my firstborn. Well, I actually paid the firstborn a few years ago. But, you know, when you owe the IRS a bunch of money, you want to make sure that, you know, you take care of that obligation. No unwelcome visitors, thank you. But, you know, just the idea that this is not the time of year where there is expendable income. If you're planning family vacations, or, you know, you've got household members who are going off to college, if their graduation, and, you know, there's all kinds of different areas competing for the finite amount of revenue that you have there. So, I mean, we could go on and on about this. The fact of the matter is, it's a well-deserved honor, as the Congressional Gold Medal will be going to the Smithsonian. But the duplicates that are available, and if you can afford it and want it, then you should get it. If you can't, then you could pursue other avenues. But, you know, that's just what it comes down to, lest we not forget. It took quite a while to get this medal presented, because it was a long time ago where it was actually passed into public law. So it's good that it finally happened, and happened earlier this week. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Hey, yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, it's definitely, as you say, important topic, well-deserved honor and all that. you know, I attended the Crystal Clear Showcase coin show in Kansas City a few weeks back. And talking about tokens and metals, stopped at there at the show, I got a couple Masonic pennies from Missouri, add to my Missouri collection. And then at an antique mall nearby, I was fortunate to stumble into some Missouri tokens and some other, I found a really neat St. Patrick's medal. The seller had it described as a coin. I haven't verified this, but I'm fairly certain, as I just dropped it, thank goodness it's in a plastic, that it's a 1 ounce silver round, and they had it there for $5. So, you know, you can occasionally find a good deal in that regard. But I was rekindled my passion for Missouri tokens and metals. For a long time, I haven't bought any or bought very, very few of them. I used to religiously search on eBay 15 years ago for this stuff. And this forced me to dig out the binder of those. And I've added a couple other pieces to my collection here recently. Besides those ones at the show, I've ordered them on eBay and I'm waiting for them to ship and all that. I've been very, very, very light in buying stuff just because of, looking at getting a house and trying to figure out what am I going to do with all this stuff? Because it adds up a little bit here, a little bit there. And then pretty soon it's like, I got a big pile of stuff. What am I doing with this? But there is some cheap fun to be had out there. I got some Missouri tokens for $3, $4, $5 a piece, quite a number of them, I should say. And those opportunities, there are just a lot of opportunities out there for that kind of cool stuff. So that's where we should leave that, I think.
No, we're not going to leave that. No, we're not going to leave it there. Okay, no. This is, I think it's going to be a topic for a future podcast, is where do you draw the line between collecting and accumulating? Because I think it's a mindset thing. Because if you look around, you know, what you're collecting, and if you're not collecting with a purpose, then aren't you accumulating? And I ask myself that question all the time, but then along comes the next neatest item on an auction platform. And even though I don't have a note from Botswana, well, I do now. But, you know, just the idea that, it's just something to have here, something that's really neat, something that I still get enjoyment out of looking at it. Does that make me a collector? Does that make me an accumulator? I don't know. We'll have to see what we can do about that at another time.
Yeah, we can wax poetic and philosophical about the differences therein. I mean, the simple fact that I bought a purported, what I believe is to be a silver round. I didn't buy that to collect it. I wasn't excited by the design, although it is neat. But I go, wait a minute, that's an ounce of silver and they're only asking $5 for it. Of course I'm going to buy it. That's to me, that's a no-brainer. But that's an accumulation. That's not, I don't collect St. Patrick's theme stuff, although one could. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of items out there. So anyway, that is a topic for later. Now I should get to this week in numismatic history.
All in favor? Say aye. Aye. So moved.
All right. So I got to say, it was a really cool thing to look in this week in numismatic history and find the two things that I want to talk about today. The first one is instructive because it happened on April 11th, 1930. That was when Panamanian law decreed that Panama's silver coinage should be the same size, weight, silver content, and denominations as U.S. coins. What some collectors, some listeners may not know is they may not have heard that before, but the U.S. dollar is on par with the Panamanian Balboa, and there are fractions, 1/10, 1/4, half Balboa, and those equate to basically a U.S. dime, quarter, or half dollar. Back in the pre-clad days, in the days of silver, and as the transition was made to 40% silver and then purely clad coinage, the U.S. Mint was striking these coins for Panama. And one truism that I've learned about Panamanian coinage is, besides this, is that the catalog values for them are often way higher than real retail value. So the show I was just at, Crystal Clear Showcases show in Kansas City, I saw a fair number of Panamanian coins that were priced at these exorbitant catalog prices. And I go, pass, 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 pass. I know if I wanted them, I could buy them on eBay for a lot cheaper. They're just catalog values too high. It shouldn't be. But anyway, but sometimes you find them priced right. And if they're priced right, I've even in the past bought the 10th Balboa and the quarter Balboa that are silver. I bought those examples at a price less than the current market rate for comparable U.S. silver coins, the 90% silver, as it's called, Right now, I think it's trading around 22 to 24 times face, depending on what it is. I found it at an equivalent price or less, oftentimes, just because, hey, it's the same amount of silver. It was struck at the U.S. Mint, and you can buy it at or the same price as a U.S. coin, and it has a much lower mintage, comparably speaking. The U.S. Mint also made Panamanian clad coinage, and those coins will work in many modern U.S. vending machines. Just a little secret there. When Panama then transitioned to a plated steel coinage struck at the Royal Canadian Mint in the last 20 years, that is no longer the case. But the earlier coins, you know, they you can put that quarter Balboa in the slot at Aldi and get it to work just like you could a U.S. Quarter. But so I found that interesting that I knew it happened. I didn't realize the when of it. And it was on this day, April 11th, 1930. Another interesting thing, just as an aside, April 10th, 1793, that was when then chief coiner at the U.S. Mint, Henry Voigt, delivered to the Mint Treasury 6,000 cents. So would love to have been a fly on that wall, but we cannot, alas, go back in time. So that's this week in coin in numismatic history.
Well, yeah, that's great choices there, because you represent a couple of different eras and get a good feel for some of the things that have been going on here. So we're going to get a little more recent, I think, with a look back in coin world history, because we weren't around in 1793. Or even in 1930, for that matter. So, well, we're going to go back a little ways. For some reason, you know, the 80s have been a lot on my mind here lately. I went back 40 years to 1984 for some of the research, picked up some 1985 too. But let's go back a little further than that and then take a look at what we had on the pages of Coin World.
Sure. So I went with 1982 because that was the year that a book that our interview subject this week, Joe Cronin, referenced this book in his new book. It's his book is sort of a companion or follow up to the book that was published in 1982. And so I went to the latest issue to this time. And that was the April 14th, 1982 issue. And what, to my wondering eyes, did appear on page six, but a story about the release of that book. The headline reads, Stuckey Relates Story of Counterfeit Nickel. The bizarre story of a New Jersey counterfeiter who coined no P 1944 nickels that were given a clean bill of health by the Bureau of the Mint is recounted by Dwight H. Stuckey of Charleston, South Carolina, in a fascinating pamphlet that reads like a bungling whodunit. The Henning nickel is the topic of both Mr. Stuckey's book and the book you'll hear about in just a few minutes with Joe Cronin. And the story on page six of this 1982 issue talks about, presents that backstory to Stuckey's book and the Henning nickel, and how even the U.S. Mint confirmed the coins were good, and then later they were found not to be good. And so it's one of my favorite episodes from Numismatics. We've talked about it a few times on the show before, especially with Winston Zach, author of Bad Metal, the Bad Metal trilogy, I guess, or maybe there's a fourth one as well. He's two of them are out and he's working on a third one now in any event. So I couldn't not mention that just because of the serendipity of it all and the connection to what you're going to hear about in the interview in just a few minutes.
Nice. Letter-wise, we only had a few things on the letter page from the April issue, April 14th issue of 1982. And one of the last letters was, what's wrong? What's wrong with our government? The great silver sale flopped. When the government decided to sell some of their surplus silver to help the economy get back on its feet again, they forgot the most important thing. When a large amount of silver is sold at once, the price will go down due to the simple law of supply and demand. The government not only sold some silver, they flooded the market. Trying to make a profit by selling the surplus silver when the market was up was a good idea, but dumping over 1.5 million ounces a week was ludicrous. The sale of that much silver on the market will cause the futures prices to decline rapidly, and that's exactly what happened. The market still hasn't fully recovered from their rash decisions. To top it off, when the price of silver declines, gold usually follows suit along with the stock market. When the stock market drops, so does our economy. The government's sale of silver is definitely one of the direct causes of our recession. I believe this silver sale will go down in history with the General Services Administration Carson City dollar sale, the Hunt Brothers, and the Great Depression. That letter coming from Chris Hoffman, and he was located in Denver. And of course, with all the talk about what gold's doing, what silver's even doing, you know, a lot of talk, a lot of thoughts been going into the bullion side of things that have been happening. And we've been watching on the sidelines to see how that goes. Some of you more active than that, getting in on the actual play. But this letter talking about an event that happened 42 years ago when the government decided to put silver back out in the market. Thought that was an interesting letter.
Yeah, very cool. It's certainly the silver sale, the GSA and all that, and back when silver certificates were still a thing and you could redeem them. That's such a fascinating time in the hobby. Such a, you know, it would have been so cool to have been present for that and to have been able to participate in that. This whole Henning Nickel thing is a reminder, take advantage while you can. I mean, I had a chance to buy one 6-7 years ago for like $50 and did not. And now it's 3 to 4 times that in value. So, I definitely messed up in that regard. But, and you always kind of wonder what's going to be the thing that I look back on 20 years from now and wish I had been able to do or did. So that's fun. Thanks for sharing that. Now that you've done that, though, I need to ask you a question and you get to answer, and then I'll ask you another question and we'll wait till the next episode. And this one it's appropriate because it involves the 5-cent coin, the nickel. And last week I asked you or mentioned that a lot of folks think the wartime nickels from the Philadelphia Mint were the first coins struck at the Philadelphia Mint to carry a P mint mark. But that is not true. What were the actual first coins struck at the Philadelphia Mint to feature the P mint mark?
Thank you, Bill O'Rourke. It is the 1941 coins for the Netherlands East Indies.
Yeah, I thought I was going to stump you with it, and darn it, but you found the answers. And yeah. And actually, I think I want to say they may have been done for Netherlands itself in 41, but certainly the Netherlands East Indies ones, that's a fun area. One of my hobby horses, pun intended, is the U.S. Mint struck coins during World War II, and I often see those. And the Filipino stuff, it's common, it's affordable, it's fun. It's definitely something that folks should look at. And that is a good trivia question. Maybe not a stumper. It didn't stump you.
Let's hold off on asking another question. Let's get right into the interview with Joe Cronin. What do you say?
Okay. All right. Let's go to the interview. Here it is. The Coin World Podcast is delighted to be joined again by Joseph Cronin, the author of a new book on Henning Nickels. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for the invite.
This is your second time on the podcast, so we'd love to have returning guests. Previously, we've discussed mint errors to die for, but today we get to delve into a topic that it's one of my favorites in the hobby, although guilty as charged, I don't actually own one of these things. I love the story of the Henning Nickels, and you have just published the Henning Nickels Collector's Guide. So when did that come out?
I wrapped it up in early March, and then I sent it off. I did another edit before they printed it. There were a couple things I wanted to change, but it should be out. Hard copies available in my hands in roughly about 2 weeks. There was a bit of a a delay on a couple things. But I think everything's square. I know the pages and the covers have been printed. I'm just waiting for the binding. But I'm hoping by about April 25th, everything will be in my hands and hard copies ready.
You can start filling orders, mailing these suckers out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got to get more mailers, too, now that I'm a little short.
So for those who aren't familiar and haven't heard us discuss Henning Nichols on the podcast before, can you describe what is a Henning Nichol? I've heard of all sorts of U.S. coins, but I've heard of a Morgan dollar and a Barber coin. What's a Henning Nichol?
Sure. A Henning Nichol is a counterfeit Jefferson nickel that was made by a man named Francis Leroy Henning, who was a serial counterfeiter. Instances that we know about, he had counterfeited some currency and served some time for that in the 1930s, produced Jefferson nickels in the mid-1950s. And then while he was on the run, when he was a suspect for doing this, when he fled from the Philadelphia area to Cleveland, he was in the process of, again, faking currencies. So he actually got caught three different times and was sentenced to prison twice. So a Henning Nichol is essentially, it's a counterfeit Jefferson nickel. And there are some dye markers where you can distinguish them from not only genuine Jefferson nickels, but also other counterfeit ones. And other counterfeit nickels that really have nothing to do with him. They're just people just like to fake stuff, like make lead casts and white metal casts and stuff like that. And there's a lot of reasons why they become popular and increasingly more popular. Because normally, you know, the last thing you want to hear is a coin is damaged or a coin is fake. But these are probably one of the few fakes that are worth well more than almost all of them in any grade, because, you know, the Jefferson Nichol series, for the most part, is pretty easy to complete, you know, depending on how far you go with it. Like, you include varieties and proofs and, you know, other stuff like that. But they're worth quite a bit of money. And depending on the date, they can be worth upwards of about $1,000.
Wow. That that gobsmacks me. You know, but I think the fun part of the story to me is the idea of how Henning was caught and how at least some of his works can be identified, and the idea that there was I've heard this is, and you can correct me, you're the expert here, that weren't a bunch of these coins tossed into the river or a lake or something like that, and as he was fleeing authorities.
Yeah, so essentially what he was doing, he made several dies. He made dies for dimes and quarters. But he actually went through and made nickels. And unfortunately, with one of the dates that he counterfeited was a war nickel date. And in the Stuckey book, which actually covers more of the entire story of what happened, he had neglected to ensure that a large mint mark above Monticello was on his 1944 date. And there were a number of these that were found by collectors. There was someone at a bank in the Philadelphia area, just across from New Jersey, where all of a sudden bank tellers noticed that, you know, they were all the same date in this roll, and they all, you know, had this similar look, and turned out they all had similar flaws. So he, what really got him noticed was that people started seeing that the war nickels were missing the mint mark. And through that, some of these were sent to the U.S. Treasury, where the Secret Service took a look at them. And they did, you know, various tests in which they found a couple other flaws and a couple other things in common. And when people started noticing these flaws on other dates, they started realizing this is a bit more expansive than they thought. And then there had been some reports in local newspapers about, you know, coin collecting clubs that had found stuff, and they sort of advised the Secret Service of what's going on. And they were, after the reports were published, being in former law enforcement, one of the things I can tell you is that if there is a particular crime that is being committed and they currently have no leads and no suspects, one of the things that law enforcement does is they start interviewing people who have been convicted of the crime they're looking into. So, you know, if all of a sudden there was like, you know, tractor trailers being stolen or certain parts taken off semi trucks that were going missing, or in this case, coin counterfeiting. I mean, how many people, you know, within a population have been arrested for counterfeiting? So he was pretty confident that when this story in the Philadelphia area broke, that at some point they would be coming for him. And actually, they already had had stopped by to see him before, but they hadn't caught him in the act. And then when the story went public, he had left his job in Philadelphia and accepted a job in Cleveland. And it didn't take long for the authorities to trace him. What actually happened was one of the final nails for him was that in a different part of the state, people were complaining that they were getting slugs, like an unstruck, round piece of metal, in their change from pop machines. And so the police got involved, and they had traced these machines giving out slugs to a building in Ariel, New Jersey. And when the authorities went there and they found what else was going on there, and they contacted the Secret Service, this was kind of like the Secret Service's like missing part, where they finally found in the Philadelphia area where they think these things were being made. They found some equipment, they found some slugs, they found some struck coins, and they talked to the person that he had leased the building from. And through the lease, the Secret Service found out who it was, where he was working. They interviewed people where he was working at Day and Zimmerman in Philadelphia, and said, no, he took a job, you know, out in Cleveland. And it didn't take long for them, once they knew he was in Cleveland, that they pretty much went there and arrested him very quickly after they knew exactly who he was working for now in Cleveland. And before he left, he tried to destroy as much evidence as he could. And he took some of his struck coins that he wasn't able to circulate. He dumped them in a couple rivers. One was Cooper River in New Jersey, and one was the Schuylkill River in Pennsylvania. And he was pretty cooperative when they caught him, although he refused to divulge all his secrets. He felt that, you know, outside of being a counterfeiter, he had a legitimate, invention that he didn't want to give up and didn't want to make public, because that could be made public in court records and people could take his ideas. So he just gave them as little information as possible, just so that he could say he was cooperating. And the authorities did go to one of the rivers, and they found roughly like 14,300 examples. And in the other river, they didn't find any of them, or at least not yet. And they didn't find his dyes. He said he threw all his dyes in the river. None of his dyes have been found. But it was essentially the Wornickel date that got him in the most trouble.
That was the dead giveaway. The fact that it wasn't struck with the mint mark, and I guess it wasn't, was it silver either? I mean, was that?
Yeah, none of them have silver content. But, you know, oftentimes, unless a coin is very, very well circulated, sometimes, you know, you can't really tell, you know, that a Wornickel is silver or not. Like, they weigh the same, so that's not really going to help you in determining, you know, which type it is. And oftentimes, you know, they both kind of have a uniform color. It's the more circulated examples where you can clearly tell that, you know, a coin is silver. And the other thing I found is that, you know, despite nickels having a lot of lamination errors and cracks and stuff, like, I've never seen a Henning nickel with any kind of lamination or separation or anything like that. I've never seen one. And I've probably handled at least in my hands about 400, seen pictures of a couple other hundred. I've never seen one with laminations, which is very, very odd for Jefferson Nichols at that time, that they usually have some type of small, you know, lamination or peeling or something like that. And Hennings don't have any of that. And they also don't look silver, being, you know, in very poor grades of like very good to fine. So, yeah, he didn't have silver. And because, you know, his whole point was to produce nickels at 3.5 cents per nickel, make a nickel and a half, or make a cent and a half profit by exchanging them for genuine ones, which in, you know, 2024 dollars, you know, if he made half a million and he successfully, you know, exchanged them in for genuine currency, on 2024 dollars, he would have been looking at around $85,000 profit. You know, I say, people say, why would he counterfeit a nickel? I mean, remember, this is in the 1950s. A nickel isn't what a nickel is worth today. You know, a nickel is worth probably about 60, 65 cents. If I saw 65 cents.
Yeah, a nickel ain't worth a dime anymore. Anyway, so the 44 was the giveaway, but what you mentioned Stuckey, and I want to give the man his due. That's the counterfeit 1944 Jefferson nickel by Dwight H. Stuckey. If that book was an ENIAC computer, your book is a MacBook Pro, you know, top of the line, brand new update stuff. So the 44 was the dead giveaway because of the mint mark, but we know that Henning made other year dates counterfeits. What other dates do we know? And talk about how the conventional wisdom has been for a long time. There's a couple different ways you identify these. Your book discovers additional information, new information, how to take that area and expand it even further.
Right. The Stuckey book is still a book. If you're a Henning nickel collector, that's definitely a book you got to read, because Stuckey's book really is more on the entire story. And he is the book is only limited because, you know, in 1982, there's been a lot of information that's come out since then. For example, like how many, you know, Henning talked about he made six obverse dies with six dates. And as of right now, there are five known dates. There's 1939, the 1944, the 46, 47, and the 53. But a guy named Winston Zach, who you probably know, has wrote a book, Bad Metal, and he's coming out with additional volumes of that. The first is on copper and nickel. Winston Zach is someone who proved that the sixth obverse die on the sixth date is known, but, well, I don't want to give too much away here, but he proves that there's a sixth date, and he goes by die markers on the obverse side of one of the dates to prove that this was used two different times. So the Stuckey book, that information really hadn't been looked at or studied yet. So the Stuckey book is really the story, and it has a lot of artifacts in there. Like he goes deep into, you know, the statements made by Stuckey to the Secret Service, and he gives copies of receipts. And how my book differs, I spend just very little time on the actual story. I give bits and pieces throughout the book. So my book is really like, how to identify them. So over time, as I started collecting these and I just started reading what I could and realizing that the literature out there is very limited and some of it is wrong, I was just going to like coin clubs and presentations talking to people, and everybody was asking me for literature on it. And just like my mint era book, I thought, you know, why not just write a book on it? And, you know, when you have information that a lot of people can use and it's worth something, you know, there's no harm in making money at it. So I wrote the book. So the dates are 39, 44, 46, 47, and 53. And I'll let the readers either read Winston Zach's book, Bad Metal, Copper and Nickel, or my book to let them know what the sixth date was. And how Winston Zach went about proving it.
But, yeah, Winston has been on the show twice as well. Each time he's come out with an edition of his book, because, you know, as you know, it's expansive, intended to be a trilogy, I think, or four.
Yes.
And he's I've seen two come out so far. So it is definitely I love this modern era of numismatic publication. This is the golden age of numismatic publishing in so many ways, when people can come up with hyper specialized or even broad interest stuff and get it published. And, you know, we have so much information available to us. But your book takes the information that's available and makes sense of it. And also, I think should be commended the way you teach the reader just to, you know, approach errors in general. And when you encounter something that's different, you know, think through, you know, you have a part early on in the book where, you say, become familiar with the minting process. You know about fake coins, fake slabs, all these. There's so many variables at play. And, you know, you really make sense of it for somebody who especially is at the beginner stage and maybe hasn't considered some of those. So I guess the you mentioned you've personally handled about 400 of these Henning nickels. Is there any, I don't remember it from Winston's book, and I don't recall seeing it in here. Is there any idea as to how many of these things are actually out there, you know, that's still to be collected today?
Well, if we believe Henning, who the statements that I've seen that he gave to the Secret Service and the evidence that the Secret Service was able to prove, he really hasn't been lying to them, and he really had no interest in lying to them when he was caught, because, you know, clearly lying to federal investigators would just tack on more charges. But he didn't really always volunteer everything. So if he said, and there's a couple of conflicting statements, because at one point he said, to his knowledge, I produced $15,000 worth of nickels, which is roughly $300,000. But then in other parts, there's talk that he, you know, dumped $200,000 in two different rivers, and that, you know, the plan was to make $500,000. So if the plan was to make $500,000 and the authorities believe he dumped $200,000 in each of those two rivers, that would leave $100,000 left. They, you know, they found, you know, some that weren't released when they raided his mint. So I don't know. I know a lot of speculators think roughly 100,000 wound up coming into circulation. I don't really know if it's quite that many. But it's just by doing the math, if he produced roughly, you know, between 300,000 to 500,000 blanks, that you know, $100,000, I wouldn't say is far fetched just by doing the math, but I don't know. I think it's less than that, but how much? I really have no idea. I don't know if anyone really does know how many really got released.
Well, you've given me a new incentive. I've always set aside the 5 cent Jefferson nickel from 1957 and earlier, I think it was, because there's a friend who buys them for 7 cents a piece. Woo, you know, but I just throw them in a pile, and every once in a while, hey, here you go, you know. Now I need to start looking at those closer to look for some of these other dates that you know, that there's Henning's known. You mentioned the well-known dates and the one that we're going to leave to the listeners' own learning. Is it fair to say, it's my sense that this is the case, that the 1944 is the one that is the most common, because everyone knew for so long that that was a Henning nickel? But let's talk about which ones are common, which, so to speak, and which ones are rare.
The 44 is definitely the one that you come across. I have a couple friends, one in New York State, and one actually not too far from Washington, D.C. And these are people who own businesses where they go through dozens of circulated bags of nickels a week. They just, I don't know how they procure them, but It's just, they said, yeah, I've gone through so many bags. And there's a couple sources that always, you know, I always pay retail price if they find the headings. But, you know, and I think Winston Zach said roughly like well over 90 to 95%. If someone has a heading nickel, it's going to be a 1944. They're the easiest to identify. They're the ones you most often, you know, if you can go on eBay or auction houses and you look up sales, it's predominantly what those are. You really kind of got to dig deep to find other dates. Right now they're selling for, when I first started looking for these things about 7 or 8 years ago, I could get them for like 40, 50, 60 bucks. And now, even the most common date, the 44s are selling anywhere from 175 to 225, you know, depending on the condition that they're in. The other dates, the second most common you would find, which you only see a few listings for a year on eBay, is 1939. And then after that, there aren't too many more 1947s you'll find available. 1946s are very difficult. And with what's known as the looped R that's on many of these, the 1953, you might see one every couple of years. I only know of about seven 1953s with looped R's just because, you know, the Henning collectors are kind of tight and pretty close, at least those who chose to, you know, to openly dialogue. But the 1953 with the looped R, again, another easy identifier. There are very few, and 1946 isn't too far behind that. So in terms of like monetary values, on the high ends, you know, 44s go for around 200, 39s can go for around 400 to 500, 47s around 600 to 800, 46s around 600 to 900, and the 53s anywhere from 800 to about 1100.
Yeah, you mentioned a looped R, that's in the E Pluribus Unum, right? Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, there's, it looks like, it's a recessed hole. It almost looks like a needle's eye, where there's a hole. It's actually not too dissimilar. Although it's raised on the 1893 S, like if you want to verify an 1893 S Morgan dollar, on the bottom left leg, there's a flaw. They call it the rabbit ears, on the heading nickel. Instead of being raised, it's recessed. And, you know, depending on your vision, you can see that, you know, with the naked eye for most people. I'm in my 50s. I need my glasses now, but that's another way.
Yeah, I was just at that show in Kansas City, and I go to a show in the last year and a half, and I either have to sit down and look right at it, or I can't make sense of it. The slabs in a case, there is just, eyesight is such an important thing. I didn't mean to interrupt to derail your thought, but.
Oh, no.
It is something that is challenging my interaction with the hobby for sure these days. Speaking of interaction, though, you mentioned the community around Henning Nichols. There's a Facebook group that you've created. Talk about that quickly before we run out of time, and then I want you to refer to where people can go find your book.
Yeah, sure. I created a few months ago the Henning Nichols collectors group on Facebook. There aren't too many members because this is something that's so specific. I mean, this is even a smaller community than people that collect mint errors. So it would really be, you know, once it's officially up and running after the book is out, and I'll pay more attention to it, it would really be a page where people could submit, you know, is this a Henning based on some of the markers? Because, you know, there could be, you know, other dye markers out there that we don't know about. And in the book, I talk about, you know, one of the best ways to make sure what you have really is one, because they don't all have the same dye markers on them. And it's really, you know, incumbent upon, you know, the reader to find out what they are, you know, it's kind of save those dates aside. And, you know, I talk about, you know, there's roughly 8 different steps of what you should go through to see, do I really have one? The first one is the easiest. It's just know the different dates. And then from there, we go to dye markers and, dye markers that friends of mine have discovered, some that I've discovered. And then a couple other diagnostic tests that can really kind of wrap it up and say this is definitely one of them.
Well, now I need to go after this, hop over to Facebook and find that group and join. I'm excited to get in there. I'm also excited to find out how people can get this book. You said as this airs, it'll be a couple weeks from now. The Henning Nichols Collector's Guide. Where should they go to find this? Is this going to be at Amazon? Are you selling it all exclusively directly? How do they get in touch with you? All that good stuff.
I tried for a little bit to go on Amazon, and it was, I couldn't believe like what I would have to give up, because I make less than 20. The book is $80. That includes shipping and taxes to anywhere in the United States and Puerto Rico. And I make less than $20 a copy. So when I looked at the fees for Amazon, it wasn't worth doing it. So one of the places they can find when it's out is I will have it. One of them is on eBay, but I have to raise the price to about $105 because I lose 20% in fees. And that's also if you can only pay by credit card. I don't take credit cards. You'd have to go on eBay and pay the $105 instead of $80. Other than that, I sell them directly. People can join my Facebook page at Joe Cronin's Mint Errors Explained. They can also go and join the Jefferson Nichol Collectors Group. I have a page on that. Or if they want to go direct, my email is josephcronin@protonmail.com, or it can be jcrow57@yahoo.com. So JCRO, the number 57 at yahoo.com. And I take pretty much any form of payment other than credit card. I'll do personal checks, postal money orders, Zelle, PayPal, Venmo. I don't do Apple Pay. I don't have that set up yet. But
can I send you some orders of Jefferson Nichols?
Absolutely.
I'm kidding.
Jim, believe me, I probably have probably 20 to 25 letters or packages sent to me a month for people sending me Mint Errors to look at, or Henning Nichols or something like that. You know, as long as they pay return postage and provide an envelope, you know, I don't charge. I also take photographs for them. I'll send them HD photos that they can use. I don't charge for that. But I do get a lot of stuff, but also I have the right to use the images from your coins if you want to send them to me. But just as long as you have return postage and a mail, you can send me anything to look at. You can send me pictures through Facebook Messenger or email me. That can take a little bit longer, actually, but because I got a kid now. But I'm happy to do all that. And I don't charge. I don't charge to help authenticate or look at stuff. I do it because I enjoy doing it. And I've had people like Fred Weinberg and John Sullivan who very graciously helped me out many times. And I really appreciate it. And I kind of do the same thing. I don't charge to look at stuff, even directly, if you send it to me and it takes more time.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. This book, if you're not, you need to join the Numismatic Literary Guild if you're not in there. And this should be an entrant for Book of the Year just because it's such an important topic in the U.S. numismatic community. We are unfortunately out of time. I thank you, though, and appreciate it. And it's been a pleasure to reconnect here to talk about one of my favorite topics in the U.S. numismatics, Henning Nichols.
Well, Jeff, thank you, too. And, you know, I'm always available for another discussion or anything. And like I said, if you need anything, or, you know, if you are in communication with people who want something looked at, you can definitely give them my Facebook information or email, and I'll be happy to check stuff out for them.
Awesome.
Whether it's Henning Nichols errors or anything. But I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was my interview with Joe Cronin to talk about Henning Nichols. Hope you enjoyed that. We had fun talking. Joe's really a hard worker and intelligent guy, and a very an important contributor to the hobby these days with his research into these error coins and some of this other stuff. So hopefully you found that as valuable as much fun as it was for me to sit down and talk with him.
Thank you for all being a part of the Coin World Podcast.
Until next week,
happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next week.
Coin World Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about Coin World Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.